Welcome to the program for Wednesday, December 12th, 2012, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today for 12-12-12, it's Pentagon Solutions in the 3 o'clock hour. It's our deep dive conversation series where we talk to experts both inside and outside the Pentagon, talking about defense issues and looking for the solutions to those Pentagon challenges. My guest today on the program, Dr. Andrew Krepinevich, president of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Dr. Krepinevich, pleasure to see you in the studio today. You've been on the program a number of times before, but this is our first long-term sit-down. I appreciate your coming into the studio today.
Well, that's right, and it's a pleasure to be here, Francis.
Thank you very much. The latest work that you've published at CSBA's website is Strategy in a Time of Austerity, Why the Pentagon Should Focus on Assuring Access. And we've talked about this briefly when it first came out on the program, but I really wanted you to come in today because there are some ideas here that I don't think are being heard broadly around the city as we focus on where the Pentagon is headed budget-wise and so on. The first thing I wanted to ask you is you used the term austerity in the title of this piece, and I think that gets right at the heart of what the Pentagon will be up against. The general consensus seems to be that sequestration or not, the Pentagon is headed for a time of shrinking budgets. Do you agree with that, and how do you separate the two, if so, shrinking budgets and sequestration, the budget mechanism?
Well, the Pentagon has already looking at budget reductions. They had planned growth over the next 10 years of about $600 billion. They've already been told to cut $487 billion out of that. Sequestration would bump that number up about another $454 billion over the next 10 years. And I think you're right. It's either sequestration or sequestration on the installment plan. When you're talking about cutting entitlements, cutting education and so on, and particularly given the war weariness of Americans right now, I think if you ask most Americans, do you want to cut education, do you want to cut entitlements, or do you want to cut defense, most are going to say, let's cut defense.
The idea of that is something, though, that is still anathema to a lot of members of Congress. I mean, we're still hearing. It seems to be a lower voice than in the past. But don't cut defense still seems to be heard on Capitol Hill fairly regularly.
Well, there are some, and certainly you can make the argument. You know, typically we've cut defense when the threats to our security have been declining. So we cut it after the Korean War, after World War II, Vietnam, Cold War. And I think there's a perception now we're out of Iraq, we're getting out of Afghanistan, the threats are declining, we can do that safely again. I think there are some members of Congress, and certainly I've made the case, that I do think right now we're actually looking at an increase in security challenges to the country. So cutting defense can be a risky proposition under those circumstances. On the other hand, you have former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, saying, you know, the greatest threat to our security right now is our fiscal insolvency. And again, it's hard to see having a strong defense over the long term without a strong economic foundation.
Now, you talk about the threats, and I think the thing about the threats that I find the most daunting is that they are far more unpredictable than they've ever been before. I mean, it strikes me that until 9/11, we had a pretty good idea who the potential threats were going to come from, generally other nation states. That's changed dramatically, obviously.
Yes, what you have, I think, in terms of a trend, is the concentration of greater and greater destructive power in the hands of small groups. And so, for example, we saw the damage caused on 9/11. But quite frankly, we also are concerned, and Defense Secretary Panetta keeps talking about a cyber Pearl Harbor, about the fact that small groups have formed cyber criminal organizations and so on. And there's concern that, these sorts of talents used not so much to steal money, but to inflict pain on a society in other ways can cause real problems. Another area that I think would fall in the category of things to worry about 5 to 10 years down the road is we've built this enormous undersea infrastructure since World War II, primarily to extract energy. And there are literally hundreds of billions of dollars in capital assets on the continental shelves of various countries, including our own. These assets are getting easier and easier to get to. We have now drug cartels running drugs using submersibles, semi-submersibles. Commercially available, you can get these diving systems, these so-called autonomous underwater vehicles. And commercially, we've used them to find the Titanic and the Bismarck, but there's no reason that a hostile entity couldn't put an explosive on these and use it to, say, go after the next BP wellhead in the Gulf of Mexico, causing damage to capital stock, you know, loss of energy resources, and, of course, environmental damage. So, again, you know, the concentration of greater power in the hands of small groups is, in a sense, a new kind of security challenge that we faced, and I think the wake-up call was 9/11.
A couple of thoughts from what you've said there to kind of extract a little bit more out of that. The energy infrastructure that you're talking about that's undersea is primarily driven now by networks, and so they're vulnerable to cyber attacks. So those two issues are tied together somewhat. The other thing, when you're talking about the commercialization of technology that can be used for threats, I'm hearing more about the commercialization of drone technology also, that there are some fears that within the next 5 to 10 years, you and I will be able to buy drones and fly them over each other's homes, and you'll be able to see what I'm cooking on my grill. But when you think about then the next generation of that is weaponization, and somebody who really wants to do harm to somebody else can potentially do it in a short period of time.
Well, that's right. Originally, for example, these underwater systems were the province, say, 30 years ago of the advanced Western navies, us, the British, the French. You know, commercial technology, it's diffused. There are commercial applications for it, obviously. And so, again, these are the military would call dual-use technologies. You can use them commercially or you can use them to inflict destruction. The same thing in terms of cyber. If you look at the undersea infrastructure or the onshore infrastructure, we use IT, you know, we use computer programs and so on to regulate the flow of gas and oil through pipelines. And, of course, if you start to inflict malware on those systems, you can have some very nasty consequences. In fact, there's a story, it's not been substantiated by our government, that one of the first attempts at cyber warfare, successful attempts, was us in the early 1980s. Corrupting some controllers that the Soviet Union was buying to regulate the gas flows on their pipelines. There was an explosion in the pipeline not too long after they got this supposedly prohibited technology, and a lot of folks go back and cite that as sort of the onset of state-on-state cyber warfare.
Interesting. And so that then would really move the date of the beginning of that kind of technology back a decade or more from when people first think
It predated the internet, yeah. But when you have information technologies and you have computer software running and regulating, mm-hmm. There are these systems, they're known as SCADA systems, and they help, they substitute for humans in terms of, you know, do you want the valve open or shut? You know, do you want this rate of flow or not? And those kinds of systems, as we've substituted computer software for that, if you can get in and corrupt the software, of course, then over time, you can cause some severe damage. And more recently, there's a lot of publicity associated with the Stuxnet virus that somehow, some way got into the Iranian nuclear program with their centrifuges. And according to what's in the open literature, essentially it was a software that could deceive the Iranian monitors of the centrifuges, which spin at a very high rate of speed to separate out weapons-grade uranium. Give them a sense of security, but every once in a while it would begin to run these centrifuges at a higher rate of speed than tolerance. And, of course, over a period of time, a number of these centrifuges were wrecked because they essentially were spun too fast because of this malware. That was a closed system. That wasn't a system. It was air-gapped, they say. It wasn't connected to the broader internet. It was an isolated network, and yet somebody somehow got that computer code, that malware, Stuxnet, into the Iranian system.
There's a lot to talk about when it comes to cyber, and I'd like to continue that conversation later in the hour. But when we come back, I'd like to get really into the heart of the budget situation the Pentagon finds itself in today and talk about some of your thoughts about that. Dr. Andrew Krepinevich is my guest today. He's the president of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments with me on Pentagon Solutions on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Are you shopping for insurance in the same place you go to watch cat videos? Don't spend hours trolling the internet looking for cheap dental or vision plans. Call the Government Employees Benefit Association. With GEBA, you'll work with knowledgeable representatives who understand the intricacies of your government benefits and lifestyle. Based on your needs, they can offer government employees, like you, basic and enhanced policies at competitive rates. They offer comprehensive dental plans that give members the freedom to choose a dentist they know and also the ability to roll over up to $1,000 in unused benefits. With GEBA's Vision Plan, members get the advantage of competitive rates with an extensive network of ophthalmologists, optometrists, opticians, and retailers, plus an annual pair of glasses or contact lenses. Open enrollment for dental and vision plans runs from November 12th to December 17th. For more information, visit GEBA.com or call 1-800-826-1126 to speak with a representative today and stop wasting time searching online.
This is John Gilroy from Armature and host of Federal Tech Talk. After almost 300 interviews, I've had many guests who talk about cutting-edge technology and agile software development. How would you like to be part of a fast-paced team with an agile approach to projects? We need talent. We seek experts in .NET, WCF, jQuery, and HTML5. Take advantage of this opportunity where you can make a difference. For more information, go to armaturecorp.com or send your resume to radiojobs@armaturecorp.com.
There are those who dedicate themselves to a sense of honor, to a life of courage, and a commitment to something greater than themselves. They have always defended this nation and each other. They still do. The few, the proud, the Marines.
The Pentagon and Beyond is brought to you by EADS North America.
The military launched a rocket into orbit yesterday on what appears to be a mystery mission. The Air Force launched the unmanned spacecraft on top of an Atlas V rocket. It's a small, top-secret version of the space shuttle, and it is the second flight for this, the X-37B spaceplane. The craft orbited the planet for 7 months in 2010. A second X-37B spacecraft spent more than a year in orbit. I'm J.J. Green.
We have a capsized boat, two people in the water.
Every day, EADS North America builds and supports helicopters for the Coast Guard, Army, National Guard, Navy, and Customs and Border Protection.
Rescue swimmer is in the water.
EADS delivers helicopters that save lives every day, including those bright orange Coast Guard helicopters you see patrolling our nation's capital.
We got them. We're heading back.
EADS North America. Commitment defines us.
Which federal workers have the sweetest dreams? I'm Emily Kopp. On Thursday's Federal Drive, we've got the 2012 list of the best federal agencies to work. And he's got FERS, she's got SERS. This bubble couple gives us real-world advice on making the most of your retirement plan, no matter which you've got. It all starts at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for the latest federal news, check out federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Dr. Andrew Krepinevich is president of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. My guest on Pentagon Solutions today, talking about his publication, Strategy in a Time of Austerity. You use a quote in the very first paragraph of this that I found particularly interesting. I laughed first, and then it caused me to think quite a bit afterwards. You write, the British physicist Ernest Rutherford once declared to his colleagues, "We haven't got the money, so we've got to think." Why is it that you think that that's apropos of this conversation that we're having as a city and a country about what we're going to do with the defense budget over the foreseeable future?
Well, I'd say there are two things related to that. One is if you look at the last decade where we've been at war since 9/11, in a sense, the military has gotten pretty much what it's asked for. And in time of war, the American people and their representatives in Congress are not going to shortchange the American military. Strategy is a lot about thinking, and it's about making difficult choices. So, well, if you get the resources you're asking for, there's a lot less need to make difficult choices to think through. Do I really need this? Is this really the best place where I should be investing? Looking back even further into the 90s, at that time, the budgets were going down, but the threat had disappeared. The Soviets had gone away. The Cold War was over. And so because the threat was so low, even though resources were going down, there was less of a need to think really hard about, am I really investing defense dollars in the most optimum way?
The bottom line here right now, then, the military's budget will go down for the foreseeable future, and there seem to be three schools of thought evolving about how we should be planning for this. One is we should look at what is a reasonable amount of money for us to spend on national defense and then formulate a strategy around that dollar figure. And there are some who would argue that the strategy that Secretary Panetta and General Dempsey released in December was a product of that. The other is another of the three is that we should determine the threats, as simple as taking a globe and assessing threats and attaching a dollar figure and then moving the boxes around accordingly. And the third is that those two things should happen simultaneously. The third one is the more difficult, seemingly, because of how you need to do both at the same time, essentially. You're walking and chewing gum at the same time. Where do you fall on that spectrum, and why?
I fall on the third approach, which is you really have to work the two together, the strategy and the budgets. And in fact, strategy is about how you link resources to objectives. And, you know, there are some who are fond of saying, well, as you said, Francis, you know, identify the threats. What is it going to take? And that's what we should spend. Well, assuming we can agree on the threats, then the question is, what is it going to take? Well, you can never eliminate all the risk that's associated with a threat. So, you know, right away, you don't have infinite resources to eliminate every possible risk. Okay, so you're going to have to take some risk. How much risk are you comfortable taking? And what priorities do you have in terms of dealing with these threats? Some people have a lot of risk tolerance. I'm willing to take a lot of risk there because I don't think that's really a threat. Others think quite differently, and their risk tolerance is quite low. You know, they want to be able to go home and sleep at night and not worry about these sorts of things, and they're willing to pay a high price. The other question is, how do you want to deal with the threat? So, for example, the administration talks about a pivot to China. Okay, or I'm sorry, a pivot to the Western Pacific, to the Asia Pacific. And a lot of people think that the reason for that is the Chinese and their military buildup. How am I going to deal with that particular problem or threat? And some people say, well, we should defend our allies along the first island chain, which is Japan, Korea, the islands running down to Taiwan and so on. Others say we can't afford to do that. Think about blockade. Okay, well, that's another set of resources, different equipment, different approach. Some, I suppose, might say that China's not really a threat, so we should just try and accommodate them, have military-to-military contacts, and you know, we'll all be all right in the long term. Others will say, well, we're willing to do something, but what are our allies willing to do? Because the more they're willing to do, the less that we have to invest. So, you know, are we going to lead from behind, or at least we're going to require them to pony up some? Because after all, their security is a lot more at risk than ours. So, again, it's a fairly and of course, if I were President Obama or Secretary Panetta, I might look at these options and say, okay, defend the first island chain, blockade, you know, some of these other options. What are these options going to cost? Based on the cost, I may just say, well, I can't afford, I'd like to minimize the risk, but I can't afford to do that. So I'm going to choose one of these other options. So that should be, roughly what a process of reconciling the ends and means, might be. Unfortunately, strategy is a rather done well. It's a rather complicated exercise, and unfortunately, you have to keep at it because the circumstances are dynamic. Things are constantly changing: diplomatic relationships, military capabilities, and so on. So strategy is not a part-time thing. It's an all-the-time thing.
You mentioned the changing nature of the relationships. And one of the things that people who support a faster drawdown of military resources talk about is that relationship with allies, as you just mentioned. One that came to mind first as you were talking was Australia. When we think about Australia and the nature of its changing government over the past, when the Conservative government was in power in Australia, a great friend of the United States, mm-hmm. big supporter, and when I say friend, I don't mean diplomatically, I mean as far as a partnership in the military sense, were involved in Afghanistan extensively. The Labor government that's in power now is making a pretty dramatic outreach to China, policy-wise, has drawn down, or if not entirely withdrawn from Afghanistan, and so forth. And so that just strikes me as one example of what you're talking about when it comes to the changing nature of these relationships that we have to keep in mind. How does that fit what were the decisions that we make today? And I mean, there's no way to anticipate who may or may not be our friends, allies at some point in the future.
Well, you raise an excellent point. We tend to talk about cutting defense spending or a lack of defense resources purely in terms of the budget. But as some of my colleagues are fond of saying, the defense budget is also being eaten from the inside out. And by that, they mean personnel costs have gone up about 50% in real terms, inflation adjusted, since 9/11. So that that leaves less money for training, less money for readiness, less money for new equipment. So there's pressure on the budget from above with reduced size of the budget. But also, if you keep the current number of people in the military, there's also pressure from within. But, to get to your point, there's also a decline in resources because our allies, our traditional allies, are doing a lot less, particularly the Europeans, in confronting their own fiscal crisis. And then if you're talking about pivoting to the Asia Pacific, there's the issue of what are our allies and partners going to do in the region? You mentioned Australia. They've done relatively well in this difficult economic time, but they're still looking at cutting their defenses. The Japanese certainly are concerned about the Chinese. The North Koreans just launched a missile yesterday. They're concerned about them. But they're sort of still stuck about 1% of their GDP in terms of defense spending, where we're up around 4%. So, one of the real issues I think that we're going to have to confront is that unlike the 1990s and until a few years ago, after the Cold War, we really didn't need allies, and we needed their vote in the UN, and we liked them to come along with us because it showed solidarity. But in terms of fighting capability, they were nice to have but not essential. We found in Iraq and Afghanistan, in long, protracted conflicts, we're going to need allies more and more. If you're going to maintain stability in the Western Pacific, as the administration has set forth in the strategic guidance, and also in the Persian Gulf in the wake of the Arab Spring and all the instability that's come out of that, we're going to need help from our allies more. But it's not going to be along the lines of a NATO partnership. We're going to have to cobble together, I think, partnerships and alliances as these threats arise. And so one of the interesting questions, I think, is going to be, given some of China's behavior in the Western Pacific in recent years, countries like Japan, Taiwan, Singapore, Vietnam, the Philippines, Australia have come to us and basically said, we see the military balance in the region shifting away from the United States, China trying to displace you. What are you going to do to maintain stability in the region? And, of course, one of our questions, I think, back to that, them has to be, well, what are you going to do as our partner of ours to help maintain? Because, quite frankly, with rising challenges and diminishing resources, we can't do it by ourselves anymore. And I think that's one of the fundamental security challenges we face. It's not so much a military hardware challenge. In a sense, it's a diplomatic challenge. You know, how can we work with these countries and, you know, not only to get them to do more, but to do so in a way that's productive, to contribute military capability that doesn't duplicate or ours, but actually fills needs. So the idea would be to get them to do more that relates to an efficiency and an effectiveness of military capability.
I want to talk about one piece of what you just said when we come back, and then I want to dig into your work and look at one particular aspect of it that I took away and get you to expand on a little bit from what you wrote about it. That's the anti-access area denial concept. My guest is Dr. Andrew Krepinevich. He's president of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and we'll continue our conversation in just a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
No one said this in a while, so here it is. A reminder. This is America. America. In America, we do great things. We dream dreams and then conceive and create and educate and just plain work until they come true. Our greatness is not past. Are you kidding? It is here and now, just as it's always been and will always be. This is a message from Force 3. We design and implement security solutions that protect the nation's sensitive data. We create borderless networks and limitless communications. We're one of the thousands of American companies that are dreaming and growing and winning. If you're interested in today's most advanced technology solutions, or if you just want to meet people who are doing great things, visit Force3.com. Force 3, let's do something great. Force 3 is a Cisco Gold partner and one of the largest providers of Cisco to the federal government. Visit Force3.com to find out more about our leading technologies.
BYOD, the employee owns the devices, they bring them into work, and then they hook up to the local network. And so this whole movement toward portable devices is actually transforming all of IT. And there are a lot of opportunities there. All the security related to BYOD, bring your own device, a lot of security issues, security policy relating there. Application development for all of these items, it's a very, very big area.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
The Washington Wizards are back.
Spins, fades, banks, scores, and one. Okafor.
Up court to Crawford. No look pass. Ariza. Stop. To it.
Crawford drives baseline. Whips it in the corner. Sheldon Mack for three.
Single game tickets are on sale now. Call 202-661-5050. That's 202-661-5050. Or buy your tickets online at washingtonwizards.com/tickets.
These days, federal agencies are exploring how to be more efficient, from cutting hidden costs to operating differently. Turn to Deloitte. We blend public sector experience and private sector insights to help defense and civilian agencies rethink, reduce, and restructure, all while strengthening your mission, so you can stretch budgets more and your staff less. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. We help government help America.
Protecting against pertussis. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. Kids who are vaccinated against pertussis or whooping cough are a lot less likely to get sick, which is a good reason to be vaccinated. It's part of the five-shot series that also protects against tetanus and diphtheria. At the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, researcher Laura Misagatis compared data on children who got the shots and those who had not in 15 California counties. She documented the benefit, but nothing is perfect, and she also found the benefit can fade.
Within 1 year after having received the fifth dose of vaccine, about 98% of children were protected against pertussis. When we moved out to 5 years, about 70% of children were protected.
The study was in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Are you ready to hear how government's contractor partners are faring in the face of government cutbacks? Plan now to attend Affirm's December 14th luncheon briefing at D.C.'s Hamilton Crown Hotel to hear the results of the 18th Annual Federal Contractor Survey. Together, we'll learn how industry is weathering market uncertainties during changing times. And don't forget to bring an unwrapped new toy for the Marines who will be collecting Toys for Tots. Register today for the 18th Annual Federal Contractor Survey, Navigating the Government Landscape, on December 14th at Affirm.
Diary entry, August 15th. My joints ache. Today I can hardly move. I need some answers.
September 3rd. I'm tired all the time. What's going on?
June 8th. I woke up with a rash on my face. I want to know why.
For answers, ask your doctor the right question. Could I have lupus? For answers, for support, for hope, visit couldihavelupus.gov or call 1-800-994-9662. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health and the Ad Council.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today's Pentagon Solutions guest, Dr. Andrew Krepinevich, the president of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. You can read more about him and read his publication, Strategy in a Time of Austerity, Why the Pentagon Should Focus on Assuring Access, linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And later this afternoon, our entire conversation will be archived there for you to hear as well. To wrap up what we were talking about in the previous segment, Dr. Krepinevich, there's a school of thought around town. It doesn't sound like you subscribe to it, but that school of thought is that as our allies become more empowered and achieve more technological and military power, it somehow diminishes the standing of the United States as a superpower or the superpower, however you happen to view that particular situation. And I have yet to see really a convincing argument for that. The idea that just because our allies become stronger, the implication we become weaker doesn't seem to follow to me. Do you think I'm off base, or do you think I might be on the right track there?
Well, to the extent that our allies do more in terms of providing military capability to secure our common security interests, that relieves some of the strain on us in terms of having to spend on defense to achieve a certain level of risk. It frees up resources that we can invest in our economy, in our technology, and so on. In fact, that's often been a complaint of Americans that we're spending all this money on defense, and countries like Japan, for example, that's spent at 1% of GDP relative to our 4%, that they've been able to essentially play the role of a free rider, that they get security on the cheap. They can invest more in ways to compete with us economically, and therefore, in the long run, they're better off. And so, again, it depends on how you look at it. I would say that if you have allies that are willing to increase their level of effort to make us either more secure at a certain level of our expenditure, or allow us to reduce our expenditures and put that money to use elsewhere and those resources to use elsewhere, that's a benefit. That's a win-win.
I can imagine that conversation in diplomatic circles taking two different forms. One form would be, we just want to give you some warning. We're having these budget issues. We're not going to be able to do all the things that we can do, and so we'd like to let you know that you might need to prepare. Or they could be maybe a little bit more direct than that, in that, we can't do this anymore. You're going to have to, it's time for you to step up. Or is there some middle ground between those? They sound fairly disparate, and yet I wonder if there's an.
Again, I think, part of it is almost human relationships. On a personal level, do your allies believe that, the leaders of your country are committed to their interests of the common defense? On another level, it's, well, what are you doing? So I think right now the jury's out on this pivot to the Asia Pacific. The countries in the region hear us talking, but it's not quite clear what kind of actions we're taking. A few hundred Marines that are going to be based episodically in Australia, I don't think is their idea of a major military commitment. Now, we are going to move more of the fleet out there and so on. But the fleet can move around pretty readily. So if there's continuing problems in the Persian Gulf, the ships can up and sail somewhere else. So I think it's a combination of things. It's your track record, how reliable of an ally has the United States been in the past, and what's your perception of that. So, again, a number of factors will come into play, I think.
We could do an entire hour just discussing the vagaries of those relationships and the strategies that are involved there. I want to touch on something and that you is the focus of this work, Strategy in a Time of Austerity. You write about anti-access area denial, A2AD. I'd like you to explain what that term means to start with, please.
Well, the term has been developing for about 20 years now since I worked in the Pentagon in the Office of Net Assessment. But essentially what it speaks to is the fact that the American way of war in terms of projecting powers, we pick our stuff up. We move it to forward bases overseas, major ports, major air bases, and so on. We build up mountains of supplies, and then we project power. Then we engage in combat. And that has worked very well for us, building up supplies in Britain in World War II, in South Korea in the Korean War, and you can go right on down the line to Kuwait in the Gulf War. The problem now is that technology is diffusing, and there are concerns on a number of levels. One is we're losing the near monopoly our militaries had over precision-guided weaponry. Second, more and more countries are acquiring the ability to strike at long ranges. Again, the North Koreans just launching a missile yesterday, a rather substantial range, perhaps putting a payload in orbit. So you combine these two, the ability to strike at long distances with high accuracy. Let's take the Western Pacific as an example. We have two major bases, Kadena in Okinawa and Anderson Air Force Base in Guam. In recent years, the Chinese have been fielding more and more missile forces. The accuracy of those systems are getting better. And so essentially what you have is you have a lot of eggs in very few baskets. And you can get to the point where allies begin to view the presence of these forces as more of a liability than a factor of reassurance. So the concern is that combining the ability to strike at long ranges with precision, and also there are other elements to this. To take China again for an example, the development of the Chinese submarine force, the Chinese are developing a missile they call the DF-21 that can maneuver. And then with the idea of striking mobile targets like aircraft carriers. And so anti-access, essentially pushing out American forces away from your border, denying them the ability to project power the way they have in the past, anti-access, area denial, sort of in a similar vein. In other words, a keep-out strategy, creating a no-go zone in the Western Pacific, which if you look at some of the Chinese military writings and if you look at how rising nations have behaved historically, this is something you ought to expect. And the Iranians are trying to do it in a more modest way in the Persian Gulf region. So, the critical question is, I think, and I mentioned this in the article, is less and less how do we less and less thinking about regime change, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq or anywhere else, and more preserving access in the face of this kind of challenge. We don't need to conquer other countries, but if we're going to have an economic recovery and we're going to have economic growth, we're going to have to maintain access to key trading partners because we are part of a global economy. And we have key trading partners in Europe and the Western Pacific, certainly key trading partners in terms of energy in the Persian Gulf. So the strategy should be based more on preserving access to key regions and also key domains, space, cyberspace, the sea, and the undersea, than in thinking about power projection for the purpose of conquering and long-term stability operations and those kinds. And again, you're making a choice there. And thankfully, we also have ways of reaching out and touching countries without invading them. We have the ability to strike at long ranges. We have cyber weapons, for example. We've shown that special forces can be positioned very effectively in remote areas. So it's not as though we're giving anybody a free ride. But again, it's part of prioritizing what's really important when you have limited resources and how do you go about protecting that.
Dr. Andrew Krepinevich is my guest. He's president of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. We'll talk more about A2AD when we come back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Yeah. We think federal employees deserve a big
extra
thanks for all their hard work. That's why at the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Service Benefit Plan, we've added benefits at no added cost, from free well child care to free immunizations. After all, you've earned them. No wonder more federal employees choose Blue Cross and Blue Shield than any other coverage. To learn more, call 1-800-411-BLUE or visit
extras.fepblue.org.
The leader in informational seminars on federal benefits, financial, and retirement planning. NITP was established in 1984 and is 100% devoted to federal planning seminars. The mission is to educate federal employees and enable them to make fully informed decisions regarding their financial futures and retirement options. Through a variety of teaching platforms and seminars, NITP has the experience to help with your planning needs. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com for more information.
Who are the top leaders in the federal government? Federal News Radio wants to know, who has inspired you and what qualities do you think make a great leader? Nominate someone today. A top leader can be someone who knows how to motivate a team to success, or a mentor to younger coworkers. A top leader can be anyone. You tell us. Nominations will be accepted through January 8th, and finalists will be announced as part of a Federal News Radio special report in February. Find the nomination form at federalnewsradio.com. Search Top Leaders.
Life is long and filled with challenges. Navigating these can be difficult, but it doesn't have to be. Hi, this is Lisa Millman from AFMA. For over 133 years, AFMA has been leading military personnel through difficult times to a more secure future by offering the right products and services at the right time for the best price. Our low-cost life insurance and personal approach allow us to help you plan wisely and feel comfortable that your family will be taken care of. Our unparalleled survivor assistance services will allow your family to take a deep breath and relax, knowing we'll take care of everything. When you choose AFMA, you choose a partner who will provide guidance, simple solutions, and personalized care. Our life insurance policies are available to all members of the Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard. For a free life insurance quote, call a membership coordinator at 1-877-398-2263 or find us online at AFMA.com today. That's AAFMAA.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest on Pentagon Solutions today, Dr. Andrew Krepinevich. He's president of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and he is author of Strategy in a Time of Austerity, Why the Pentagon Should Focus on Assuring Access. And you can read that, I'll link to it now, on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Now, you're writing about the fact that this strategy, you write, would play into several of the United States' competitive advantages. We've talked about the regional alliances that we have and the nature of them being different, it would seem to me, in the 21st century than they were in the latter part of the 20th century with very formal NATO and others. Is it your sense that those alliances will be more informal and more fluid than they've been in the latter part of the 20th century?
I think so. If you look historically, NATO has really been an anomaly, an alliance that has held together for a very long period of time. I think if you look, for example, at the two regions that the administration, I think, rightly cites as its highest priority, the Asia-Pacific and the Persian Gulf region, there's the possibility maybe for what some people call hub-and-spoke kind of relationship. So we have an alliance with Japan. We have an alliance with Korea, for example, one with Australia. But there is no NATO Pacific. And we also have, I think, what people would call partnerships, informal partnerships with countries like Singapore. We have a very, very informal, I think, partnership with Taiwan. We certainly have a form of security commitment there. We've been trying to cultivate India, for example, for a number of years. They live in a very dangerous neighborhood. They have problems with terrorists, problems with proliferation, and certainly concerns about what China's ultimate aims are. But they hold us at arm's length. And I think, again, it's going to be a case of where you've got countries that have common security interests, but in a sense, NATO came out of a horrific experience, World War II. These countries have not been pushed to the wall the way that the European countries were then and weren't as weak as they were right after the war. And needing that kind of support. In a sense, the history of the last century, the 20th century, was World War I, World War II, Cold War, countries coming to the United States saying, we need your help. You know, please be an ally of ours. The history so far, the 21st century, has been to the United States going to other countries and saying, we need your help. We need you to be allies. And so far, very few of those folks have been at home when it counted.
The focusing on assuring access strategy that you're proposing, advocating in this work, is that, will that result in higher risk, lower risk, or will it not make a difference in the risk assessment that we do as we go through some of the policy-making decisions that we've talked about today?
Well, again, the anti-access area denial has to do with the diffusion of military technology and capability. It presents a different kind of problem for the American military. It undermines its traditional way of projecting power. And so, you know, part of the part of what comes next, in a sense, is the American military deciding, what are you going to do about it? Can you find a different way of projecting power? Can you do it at an acceptable cost? You know, what are the risks associated with this? Or is this sort of a new normal? You know, we had a free ride. You know, power projection costs were relatively low for a long time. Well, guess what? That's over. And so instead of just, you know, parking in Kuwait or on the coast of Vietnam during the Vietnam War at very low risk, projecting power is going to be more like Omaha Beach on D-Day. You know, you're going to suffer a lot of casualties. You're going to pay a much higher cost. We don't really know the answer. And the Pentagon is particularly the Navy and the Air Force, working on this concept called air-sea battle that is designed, at least from what we know, to help them address this problem. And so, you know, what's the best way to do it? Can you do it at an acceptable cost? What can you get your allies to do? All these things will come into play, I think, as they try and determine whether we're at a new normal where we're really locked out of certain areas or whether we have the ability through different kinds of capabilities, different ways of operating to reestablish our ability to project power at an acceptable cost.
You write, a strategy of assured access reflects a sense of what the U.S. military can realistically achieve, and you write about some scenarios. The goal would be to keep a conflict limited. This would be similar to the Iraq strategy of President George H.W. Bush, not that of President George W. Bush, the Korea strategy of President Truman, not that of General MacArthur. That implies a more hands-off approach to the foreign policy aspects of power projection. Is that a fair derivation
on my part,
or is that where we start to get
important issue? So let me address it. If you look at the Western Pacific and the Persian Gulf, the big challenge in the Western Pacific is China. Yeah, there's no way we're going to do regime change in China. I've talked to folks and I've said, you know, kind of reminds me of what Bismarck said when somebody once asked him what Germany would do if the British landed a force on Germany's coastline. And he said we'd have to send out the police and have them arrested. I mean, there's just we're not doing regime change. Iran, we may do regime change there. I mean, the regime may fall of its own weight because it's so unpopular. But Iran has three times the population of Iraq, we're just not going to do that anytime soon, absent some incredibly provocative act on their part. So again, we don't need to conquer Iran, we don't need to conquer China, we don't want to. Basically, what we want to do is preserve access to our trading partners in the region to be able to participate in the global economy, and that should be the focus, especially when resources are limited the way they are now and the way they're likely to be in the future.
And I think your assessment of where we are politically and foreign policy-wise is backed up by what we're seeing in the debate on Syria, with the fact that there were a few people who have expressed a desire for regime, for us to be the proponents of regime change in Syria, and yet that hasn't really taken fire.
The Pew Foundation has been doing polling going back to the late 60s, and they run this poll on a regular basis, asking Americans whether they support an active American role in international relations, security affairs, and so on. They took the poll like a year or so ago, and it was the lowest support for that kind of action since the Vietnam War. So, the American people in the wake of Afghanistan and Iraq seem to have little stomach for that. And then when you put on top of that the fiscal problems we have, Again, it just seems hard to see where the support is for those kinds of operations anytime soon.
I commend your work to anybody who wants to understand this issue of access better and how it fits with our military strategy. Strategy in a time of austerity, why the Pentagon should focus on assuring access. We have a link to it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. In the few minutes that we have left, I want to talk about cyber. We've touched on it as it has impacted some of the other topics of conversation throughout the hour. But in and of itself, cyber now becoming literally its own domain in military strategy. And as the Pentagon tries to decide what the rules of cyber war should be and what are appropriate responses to various things, what are some of the challenges that you see in making policy when it comes to the cyber domain in the foreseeable future?
Well, first is we're under attack all the time right now. And so what's an act of war versus what's the theft of intellectual property, cyber crime, trying to manipulate somebody's bank account. So that's one issue. Another issue is attribution. It can be very difficult to determine who exactly is attacking you. You may be able to trace an attack back to, say, China or to Russia. That doesn't mean that the Chinese government or the Russian government is authorizing those attacks. So, if you're looking for a smoking gun, if you're going to go to war with a major power, you're going to want something more than we think it's probably them. And of course, this can lead to mischief by a third party who may be trying to start what the Pentagon calls a catalytic war between two other countries. And then finally, getting our own act together. There are a lot of concerns. We have had difficulty passing legislation to begin to organize our cyber defenses. Civil libertarians are worried about the government's intrusion on personal privacy. Firms are concerned about loss of intellectual property. Other firms are concerned that if they tell the government how often they've been penetrated, can you imagine, say, Bank of America saying, yeah, we're penetrated all the time. Yeah. You're really going to want to put your money in Bank of America. So there are a multiplicity of issues. And there are people like Secretary Panetta, like General Alexander, who commands Cyber Command, Senator Lieberman, who gave his farewell speech on the Senate floor today, who have been trying to raise the warning flag. And there are senators I've talked to who've even said, we'll take half a loaf here because of the importance we see in trying to solve this problem. But again, it's going to be a challenge for years to come.
There is a lot more that we could cover, and we have to leave it there because of time. But I'm very grateful for your time today, Dr. Krepinevich. It's great to see you.
Pleasure, Francis.
Thank you very much. Dr. Andrew Krepinevich is president of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. You can hear my conversation with him archived later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And you can read his publication, Strategy in a Time of Austerity, Why the Pentagon Should Focus on Assuring Access. We have a link on the In-Depth page as well. Hour number two of In-Depth with Francis Rose, next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.